You're listening to The Ouachita Chronicles.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Ashley.
How are you today?
Doing pretty well.
The guest that we had on for this episode, we got kind of personal with parts of it, for sure.
There were a few times where I think he blushed just a little.
Looking like Woody Harrelson sitting over there blushing.
Absolutely.
Just a cutie patootie. You know, the cowboy, it's an American icon. It's an archetype, for sure. It represents, you know, some would say defiance. It represents standing for natural freedoms and rights and kind of bucking the trend, not trying to be punny about it. But, I mean, the cowboy, it's also a romantic trope, for sure. I mean, there's how many songs and movies and an entire genre of entertainment television has been dedicated to the American Wild West and the cowboy.
I think the story of the wanderer, or someone who likes to go and explore and adventure and really live life to its fullest, you know, there's all kinds of stories throughout fiction, literature, movies about that. But what happens after the movie clip ends, after the adventure is over and he goes back home? And that's what we were able to find out. What's happened to this special cowboy after his wild rides? And so it was a very, very interesting interview for me.
And entertaining. I found it a very entertaining interview. Yeah, so our guest today is an American cowboy. Our guest is Clint Craig, a professional bull rider from Mena, Arkansas. And we had the best time visiting with him, so we're not going to wait around any longer. We want to introduce you to Mr. Clint Craig, our American cowboy. Welcome to this episode of the Ouachita Chronicles. I am your host, Ashley, with my co-host, Jerry.
Hi.
Jerry's always so enthused in the morning, so enthused. Well, we're in the studio this morning, and we've got a pretty cool guest, and, you know, one that I go way, 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 way back with. I don't want to age myself here, but, I mean, gosh, Mr. Craig, when did we meet?
Sixth, seventh grade, something like that.
Sixth or seventh grade, yeah. We've got professional bull rider Clint Craig in the studio this morning. We're very, very glad to have him.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's exciting what y'all are doing, so it's pretty neat.
It is exciting. We're having a lot of fun with it. The whole basis of our show is it's the Ouachita Chronicles, so it's people who live in and around the Ouachita region, interesting things they do or have done, people that maybe have moved off but are doing really cool things too. We're just trying to share these stories because everyday people have very interesting stories and they go untold a lot, and it's our goal to tell them. So that's what we're here for this morning. So we're going to jump right in, and we're going to start kind of like we do with most people at the beginning. Clint grew up here in Mena, Arkansas, and Clint, I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about the Craig Ranch and growing up out there.
I grew up born and raised here in Mena, or Ward Camp to be exact. My grandpa, he started the Craig Ranch, I guess, back in the 60s. Bought his first 360 acres for like $360 or something like that. Can't touch anything for that anymore.
Right, like a coke was like 10 not even cents in the, at that time,
right,
or something. Yeah.
Not even in the desert, you know. Then my dad followed in his footsteps, and he's been able to put together quite an impressive bunch of land and a lot of cattle. To me, what's impressive about my dad is that every cow that walks on the Craig Ranch, between 500 and 600 head of cattle, he's raised since the time that, you know, they've been born and raised there, and then been brought online to produce, you know, baby calves for beef.
So he can identify, I mean, he knows them.
Yes, he knows them from the time they were born, yeah. So I was kind of raised around that, raising cattle. We raise most of all our own horses and break them and stuff like that. That's not big here in this part of Arkansas. It's huge in Texas and stuff where I live now, but not as much here. So it's a vision that they had from being young kids that they've brought it on. And it's a fairly productive deal out there now.
It is a fairly productive deal. I mean, that's what sustained your family,
yes,
is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just, I don't think my dad's ever had a real job. Maybe, I think when he was young, he might have worked some construction.
I can't imagine Dale Craig doing anything being a rancher.
Working for himself. He shod horses for 23 years as well. And then my mom's a hairdresser here in town as well. But as far as just growing up, I just grew up with a rope in my hand around cattle. Heck, when I was little, until I was probably in the third grade, about 10 years old, we milked a cow, you know, so.
On the daily?
Yes.
Yeah. On the daily.
So, pretty.
Hands-on.
Yeah, hands-on upbringing, you know. Mm-hmm. And we hunted, we coon hunted from the time I was little, and that was a part of the living too, you know, back then in the early 80s. We coon hunted because fur was worth money.
Yeah.
So anything you could do, cut wood, shoe horses, trap and hunt animals for fur, you know, that was the thing as well.
There's plenty of times when the cattle market's lean.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You've got to have something too.
And then, you know, when you're first starting, there's not a, you know, you don't have a huge herd. It takes time to build up, you know, to get to where I guess he's gotten today.
So at what age did you first like really actively get involved in the operations of the ranch?
I guess there's pictures of me on horses sitting in the saddle with my dad. I would say that you're active from the time you're born, basically, more or less. Mm-hmm. So you grow up being a cowboy, and that's kind of all I ever really wanted to do. And my mom talks about how from the time I could talk, all I talked about was wanting to be a bull rider.
Uh-huh.
So there were some things that worked out and was able to pursue that.
Yeah, so. But your parents really weren't pushing you towards bull riding, were they?
No, not at all. So, you know, bull riding's said to be the most dangerous sport in the world.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've been to a lot of rodeos and seen a lot of people on bulls, but we watched some of your highlight reels and yeah, that's scary, Clint. I'm sorry. I saw a hoof come like this close to your head like several times.
Yeah, there's a lot of terrible injuries that can happen and even death. You know, the most famous one is, you know, Lane Frost was killed in 1989 in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and he was a world champion. I mean, he was at the top of his game, the best there was at the time. And it doesn't matter how good you are or how much you've won, you can't teach those bulls to read your resume. They don't care. They don't discriminate.
So they weren't pushing you towards bull
riding.
Was there another reason just besides it being dangerous?
My dad rode bulls, I guess, from the time he was 18 till about 23, and he knew how dangerous it was. And so you don't want to see your kid do something and possibly get hurt. And unless you're one of the best, it's not a real lucrative business. You know, there's not a ton of money to be made unless you're in the very top echelon of guys in the whole entire world. Mm-hmm. Unless you're in the top pretty much 15 guys, top 20 guys.
Right, you're not making a living out of it.
You're not making a lot of money and not making a living. You're more or less a glorified carny. You spend 250, 300 days a year on the road. Sometimes your bank account's negative. Sometimes, you know, you've got close to $100,000 sitting there.
Well, and in 6 months... they write all the songs about those cowboys.
Right, exactly.
Like
yeah.
Broke and all they got mm-hmm. left their saddle. And...
Right, yeah. It's kind of a novelty or whatever. It's for women to like it because you're doing something dangerous or anything. But like the Chris LeDoux song says, what you going to do with the cowboy when he doesn't saddle up and ride away? So he'll camp out all night on the couch or all week on the couch and his buddies won't leave. So there's a lot of that goes on too. So,
well, it's almost like a frat party that never ends, right?
In a lot of ways, you know, there's a big business to it too, you know, because there is so much money to be won and not really fame, but success to gain sponsorships and endorsements and stuff like that at the top level mm-hmm. to where you can carry it on to where you make a living, you know, the rest of your life using it. You know, like guys to this day, they're in their 60s and they still get paid a good amount of money to endorse.
They're not riding anymore, but they're just their legacy.
Ambassadors
their
of the sport and they carry on, like Tuff Hedeman, Donnie Gay. Those are two of probably most well known from back in the old 70s and 80s.
Because Tuff was riding when Lane was riding.
Right. They were best friends.
I don't know the exact age he would be now, but surely too old to be getting on a bull.
Right. He's 56. I know Tuff pretty good. He lives right down the road from me there in Texas, and I've had the opportunity to work with him for the last 15 years of my career, and he still makes a lot of money
because of endorsements. Okay, so where are you living out in Texas?
I live in Brock, Texas. It's kind of a small town just west of Weatherford, which is west of Fort Worth.
West of Fort Worth, okay.
45 minutes west of Fort Worth.
Do you feel like if you had grown up, you know, in Texas in a town that lived and breathed this type of thing as opposed to Mena, Arkansas, where, like you said, that's not a big thing around here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've got our share of rodeos, but a lot of them are just the little play dates and it's not, you know, big competition. Do you feel like your life would have had a different trajectory by any means?
I don't know. I did what I wanted to do, you know, so I credit my mom and dad to that. So because it is so dangerous and because there's the right way to do things and there's the wrong way. And so my dad knew proper techniques and everything about how to ride bulls. And he said, if you're going to do this, you're going to do it right and you're going to do it the way we teach you to. And if you don't, you're not going to do it. And the way that I teach you to do this is the best way to keep yourself the most safe with technique and everything like that. And then whenever I first started, I was fortunate enough, God blessed me with a good amount of talent. And I was so interested. All I wanted to do was ride bulls. I watched it on TV all the time. If there was something I could throw my leg over, I was riding it. A barrel, a couch, whatever, you know, and play bull rider. And that's what you have to do to make it there. So they saw that and decided to invest a little money in taking me to these rodeos. And so from the time I was 12, we just started going to these youth rodeos.
Right. So how old were you when you got on your first bull? I mean, like
got on my first steer.
You know, I grew up not in the rodeo world, but I grew up on a farm, show circuits and everything. But I spent enough time with your family at rodeos to pick up a little bit. So what, you were riding a steer at 10.
Yes.
When did you graduate to something with some heft?
They still weigh 600 pounds, you know, 600 to 800 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I was in the seventh grade, a bull jerked me down. You're tied to him, you know, you've got your hand in the rope. And what the technique I was talking about, if you don't use proper technique, the first place you're going to go is they're going to jerk you right down on their head. So this bull was, even though he probably only weighed 750 pounds, he was a real live wire. He jerked me down and hit me right square in the nose and broke my nose, kind of knocked me goofy. And then my hand wound up being stuck in the rope, which they call being hung up, and got stomped pretty good and was kind of about halfway knocked out and got 4 stitches across my nose, broke my nose, both eyes black and everything.
I remember so, that. I remember seeing you.
Yeah. And that was when we were in the 7th grade, right at the end of our 7th grade year. You can get hurt at any level and hurt really bad.
Right.
So the way the age groups go, after you're finished with your 8th grade year, you go into the senior bull riding, which is the bigger bulls and stuff like that. And really for a 9th grader, you're too small. Even if you have the skills to ride these bigger bulls, it's so hard on your body. It's almost like a gymnast starting too young, you know, at high level competition. It's just, your body's not built to take it.
Right. Bones aren't fused right, all the way.
Yeah. And mom and dad knew if I was going to do this for a career that we got to save. And what Donnie Yeh, my mentor, who's the 8-time world champion bull rider, what he said is you win a bunch. Like if you're real talented at a young age, you win a bunch before anybody even cares or has the opportunity to know who you are. Because by the time you get 20, you're shot. You know, your body's shot. So for a year there, when I was in the 9th grade, they held me out. I didn't get on hardly any bulls. All I did was go to the practice pen and get on bulls. Like we really watched what type of bulls I got. You know, we knew what they were going to do.
You knew their routine.
Knew their routine and just kept myself sharp, but I didn't go to any competitions that year. Because of my age, I had to be in the older age groups.
It was like off-season.
Right, kind of off-season for a little over a year, about a year and a half. And then that paid off. Not until the last 3 years of my career did I really have any injuries. And I rode bulls till I was 33, which most guys don't make it to 30.
I was going
to say that. Nowadays, back in the old days, they used to, but with the breeding programs today that were really coming along, I refer back to the 70s and 80s and stuff, there were still ranked bulls back then that buck just as hard as the bulls do today.
Okay.
You might get on one of those bulls a month back in the 80s.
Right. There now, wasn't saturated with them.
Now you get on that type of bull almost, if you go to a rodeo or an event 5 days a week, you'll get on a really top quality bull 4 out of 5 times.
It's literally just harder now because of the breeding program, the quality
of the bulls. Because of the breeding program and the turnover for bulls is a bull is mature at 5 years old and they can be at the top of their game at 4 years old. Every year there's new bulls. You know, a bull rider doesn't get mature till they're 20, really, maybe even 25 in their skill level. So there's not really a breeding program for that.
No. Last couple of years of high school, junior, senior year, how many times a week were you getting on a bull?
So we'd probably go to a rodeo Thursday, Friday, Saturday, all over Oklahoma, northern Louisiana, here in Arkansas, northeast Texas. And so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, a lot of times we would go down to just right across Cerro Gordo, Oklahoma, to a guy named Jimmy Clyde and his son Bernie, who was quite a few years older than me, about 5 years older than me, that really cut my teeth and making me like a tough guy. I say a tough guy. A tough guy towards riding bulls, you know, like to where you're scared, but you face the fear every time you get on. And that really molded me into being the bull rider that I wound up kind of being. Their attitude, then the good bulls that they had for me to get on. So I would go there on Sundays, not every Sunday, but a lot. And then I would go there on Wednesdays too. And then I would also go on Tuesdays to a guy named Charlie John Coffee over by Idabel, which he has one of the most prolific breeding programs to this day in the buck and bull industry. Like you can't touch one of his animals, like just to buy the brand, basically you're spending $5,000.
Wow.
You know, because his breeding program is so prestigious. So I cut my teeth on bulls like that. So that helped me to be able to step into the professional ranks like right out of high school. I remember like the day we got out of school, I can remember the last weeks leading up to it. Everybody's excited about going to college or nervous about what they're going to do for a living, what they're going to do for a job. I can remember thinking the day that I walked out of those double doors to the parking lot there is thinking, finally, I'm free and I can go do what I want to do, what I think I was put on this earth to do. And that's ride bulls. And I got in the truck and drove to a rodeo that night.
That's going to segue right into, you know, when did you go out on the road on your own without the support of your parents, just you, truck and trailer, whatever it is you're hauling? I mean, when was that? That was when we graduated?
Pretty much.
Sayonara?
Yeah.
Mina?
Yeah, pretty much. Hit the road. I had my professional permit at the time and I was still going to a ton of amateur rodeos. Bull riding's one of the only events that can stand alone and can still bring a fanfare.
Right, draw a crowd, yeah.
And so I would go to all these amateur bull ridings all over Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. So I just kind of stayed in that area. About August after we graduated, I started really going off to these professional rodeos and I would incorporate these other bull ridings and stuff in with them. Because when you're young like that, first starting out, you don't have, they call them qualifications. So you don't have enough money, one, to get into all the big rodeos. You have to build your qualifications. So I was just working on building my qualifications so you don't get into every rodeo you want to go to. So you have to fill the void with these other smaller venues. And back then it was a paper called the Humps and Horns. And you'd get in that Humps and Horns and just figure out, all right, so I'm going to a rodeo in Albuquerque, New Mexico. where's an amateur bull riding close to there, you know, and go to Alamogordo, New Mexico. I'm out Saturday night at Albuquerque. We'll go to Alamogordo on Sunday.
I was about to ask how you plotted that out. You know, you would just lay all your papers out
and have you a map and pick out where everything was at and how it worked.
And you were doing this at 18 years old.
Mm-hmm,
you were...
Yeah. And that's a huge misconception, I think, about a lot of what rodeo is, especially around here. You think people just think of, oh, yee-hoo, we're just riding bulls or whatever, you know. And it's not to be the best and to compete at a top level. You have to really pay attention to your business, really be on top of your entering the rodeos, because you have to call and enter. You don't just show up. A lot of rodeos, you enter a month ahead of time.
Yeah, you don't have a personal assistant who's setting all this up right. for you. This is, I mean, you've got to be diligent and on top of it to get those qualifications, like mm-hmm. you said, to get into the rodeos you want to get into, to even right. get into like world standings and everything, right?
Yes, correct. You're thinking about your qualifications. My first year, you know, it was just learning the ropes. My second year, kind of learning the ropes pretty good. And then as you get out there and you're learning the ropes, you meet guys that have experience and stuff, and you figure out who you want to travel with and who you don't, you know. Mm-hmm. Guys are always like, hey man, you're going to these rodeos, why don't you go with me?
Right.
And you're like, oh, I don't know about this dude, you know. I don't know. You are who you hang out with.
Exactly.
So you want to pick the top guys, you know. So you befriend them and you figure out how to hang out with the guys that are the best, that are trying to fulfill their goals and not goofing off too much.
Were you ever starstruck at any point by some of the cowboys you would meet?
So whenever I was 15, I went to Donnie Gay's bull riding school. And at the time, that was when he did the PBR on TNN at the time. And it was called the Bud Light Cup Series at that time. And so I watched him on TV every Sunday. And then here I am 15 and go to his bull riding school. And he took a liking to me. Mm-hmm. And then we would talk on the phone about every 2 weeks. I would spend probably 30 minutes talking on the phone to him. And basically what he would do is I would be on the phone, holding the phone, sitting on the corner of the bed. And he would get me like, all right, sit like this and do this and do this and do this over the phone. And he'd say, well, what happened this weekend on this bull? And I would tell him and he'd be like, all right, this is how you fix this. I'd be on the phone, you know, holding the phone with my ear and, you know, holding my free hand up and acting like, you know, get my, like he always says, get your position.
Right.
And get your position and make the moves you would need to make to correct what I messed up. So as far as starstruck goes, you know, because I was on the phone with that guy who is the most popular bull rider maybe ever at that time.
Basically, your first contact was the top level.
Correct. Right. Which dad taught me the basics and everything. Donnie reinforced what dad was teaching me, but then he taught me the mental side of the game. Mm-hmm. How to win, what to think about, how to enter these rodeos, where to go, coached me along like that.
It seems that there's also, besides, I mean, just the basics and knowing how to correct and anticipating what the bulls are going to do, seems like there's some style to this.
Correct. I had, I guess you could call it a classic style. I set up real straight, had excellent posture on the back of a bull. And back in the day, they judged a lot on style. Now it's a lot on just kind of making the whistle. It's almost like such a fight that the style doesn't mean as much as it used to. Mm-hmm. So there's still guys that have amazing style, like the guy that just won the PBR World Champion, Jose Vitor Leme. Amazing style. Just guy that has impeccable style. JB Mooney's another guy. In my mind, he'll go down in history as the best bull rider ever that has amazing style. Like your posture, you know, keep your head down, have your chest out, be able to keep your free arm pretty still, and you turn your toes out. You have your spurs on the heels of your boots, and you turn your toes out, and you're holding on with those spurs. Like they don't cut the bull or stab in him or anything, but they're just grabbing.
It's grip.
They're just grabbing. And you're not just grabbing and holding on with one hold. You're always moving your feet. Mm-hmm. You're always shuffling for a new position. And so I had a great posture. And if you look at pictures, you can kind of see it. That's why people like Donnie Gay or Tuff Edelman took me under their wing. So that was always cool to be taken in by those guys at a really young age. But as far as starstruck, I think you get starstruck more by the massive crowd. So like the first time I rode at Houston Rodeo, so I never rode in the Astrodome. 2002 was the last year they had it in the Astrodome. I didn't have the qualifications to go that year. 2003, I had the qualifications, and that was the first year they had it in the Reliant Stadium, which is NRG Stadium now where the Texans play. And I rode there the opening night. George Strait was opening in concert.
Oh gosh.
There was 78,000 people there. Mm-hmm. That's what you get starstruck over. You stand there on the back of those bucking chutes, or you walk down a tunnel, and you know that you're walking places that football stars you've watched on TV have walked. You're getting ready in the same locker room that they got ready in.
Hallowed ground type
thing. And so you walk down these tunnels. All these arenas and stuff have these tunnels you walk down. And when you come out into the arena, they're so big. There's something to be said about sitting in the stands of these things. But when you walk out on the ground level, it just takes your breath. You know, and you're like, what am I doing here competing, you know, from Board Camp, Arkansas? You know, well, I guess I belong because I'm here, you know. And now it's time to make something of it. It's not the American Idol type of success. There's a Texas country music song that says an overnight success. But then it talks about all the long nights and being broke. And then they say, you're an overnight success, but it took you 20 years to get there.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
But I remember standing on the back of those chutes and looking up at 78,000 people and knowing that George Strait was going to be on that same stage 30 minutes later, you're in awe and mm-hmm. wow. And that's where you get starstruck at, is those moments like that. And there's a lot of them. So that night, I won the go-around. And nice. So that was a good night. You know, you handled the pressure. Sometimes you don't, sometimes you do. So.
Right.
Another thing about that classical style or whatever, I always pride myself on being able to get off on my feet. Like, I would go to anywhere between 100 and 150 events a year. So at an event, sometimes you get on two or three bulls. So I was getting on over 150 bulls a year. So that's super hard on your body. Everybody always says, well, are you healthy? Well, what's that mean? It's relative to what?
Right.
You know, you've always got bumps and bruises.
Same as my hip hurt.
And
what,
so,
you know?
Like, sometimes you can't hardly walk because your knee's so banged up or whatever. And mm-hmm. it seems like those bulls know whenever you got a hurt knee, they'll crash it on the chute
right.
or whatever. Talking about the style and stuff, one thing I wanted to say was over 14 years in my professional career, I wasn't always the most consistent bull rider. But one thing I pride myself on is 90-point bull rides. And I have right at 50. The 90-point bull ride is like the home run. I have right at 50, maybe 48 90-point bull rides. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I'm excited about. I don't know about now, but a few years ago, I was in the top 20 mm-hmm. ever of 90-point bull riders.
For people who are listening that maybe not know, I know a little bit about this. I know that the bull gets scored,
mm-hmm.
and I know that the rider gets scored.
Right.
So to get that 90-point ride, is that a combination?
Right. So there's two judges, and they each have a set of points, 1 to 25 for the bull, 1 to 25 for the bull rider. So to get a 90-point bull ride, you have to be 23 on both sides. Just 90. Usually it's a 23-point ride on a 22-point bull.
Okay.
Out of a possible total of 25 points.
Right.
So that's 45 on one side, 45 mm-hmm. on the left side. 90 points.
And it's not just about you having the skill and having a good ride, because that bull's got to come out and be
right.
doing his job
mm-hmm.
too. The bull's not doing their job, which
right.
I feel like that's probably a problem a lot of the time. But
right. You know, yeah. sometimes it is. And if the bull is what they call inferior to the pen, mm-hmm. which means the group of bulls that are out that night, you get a reride. If they don't feel like you had an ample opportunity to compete, they give you another bull.
Okay. So at the height of your career, based on what I pulled up, is the highest you ever finished in the world standings 13th?
I think I finished 9th one year. Maybe it was 13th. I'm not sure. Somewhere in there.
But this was in 2007.
2007, I think I finished 12th. That's a disappointment to me. I felt like my talent could have led me to finish higher. But
I don't think 12th in the world standings would be a disappointment to too many people, Claire.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But you want to be first, you know.
Yeah, you
if
do.
If you're not
you
first,
do.
You're
last.
It's something that you strive for is first, you know. And I think at the highest I've ever been in the meat of the season in 2010, I was sitting second halfway through the season and was having probably about the best year. Mm-hmm. 2009 and 2010, going through the best, really good, consistent, thinking things were really going in the direction to win a world title. And I tore my groin muscle in Greeley, Colorado, right during the 4th of July run. In the heart of the season, sitting second, to have an injury like that where you're going to be out at least 2 months. And then when you come back, your timing's off, your rhythm's off. And when I came back, I couldn't ride a frisky stick horse. So I wound up, I think, finishing 20th that year, you know. So it's very competitive. So in 3 months, you go from sitting second to 20th, you know.
Right.
And you don't get to go to the national finals, which the national finals is, they take the top 15 guys. It crushes you. You just got to continue to work out and continue to make mm-hmm. yourself better and come back the next
get
year and try
again.
Season.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Get ready for the next season. So. What's your favorite bull you've ever ridden? I'm sure you've got a lot of memories from riding. And I know this is something cool about rodeos and bull riding is these bulls have some names.
Yeah, they're
they've
real,
got some
they're
good
real
names.
Popular, real famous.
Yeah, they're stars in their own right.
Mm-hmm, right. And some of them have a bigger fanfare, like this bull Bruiser that belongs to HT Page. He's got a Facebook page and stuff. Like Little Yellow Jacket has a Facebook page.
Uh-huh.
You know, these bulls are famous and worth hundreds of thousands, if not
right.
$1 million in their semen sales and stuff like that for breeding bulls. But my favorite, it'd be hard to put my finger on one, but I know in 2002, 2003, 2004, there was a bull called Tahana, and he was from Washington, like up around Seattle.
Okay.
There's a rodeo company up there called Big Ben Flying Five Rodeo Company. They're known for raising big rank bulls. And this bull was actually from Canada, and he was a big kind of yellow colored bull, had some pretty good size horns. And he was the bucking bull of the year in 2003 and 4 is when he was the bucking bull of the year. He was terrifying. In 2003, I had him at Ellensburg, Washington. I was 91 points in the first round, and I had him in the short round at a bull riding event. There's 45 guys, everybody rides, and they bring the top
right.
15, top 12, whatever back. So I'm coming back in the short round, like sitting number two,
mm-hmm.
and I've got Tahana. And I remember whenever I put my rope on him, kind of in the back chutes, and when they run him in the chute and we're three or four guys ahead of me, I was 20 at the time. I remember thinking, Clint, this is what your dad always told you about. You better pay attention to what you're doing, because there's some bulls out there that can sure enough hurt you or
yeah.
kill you, and you better be paying attention right now. It's just like you see those UFC fighters, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're walking back and forth, looking, getting ready. People always say, you know, why would you do something that you have to slap yourself to get ready to do? You're getting pumped up. It's like
right.
jumping out of an airplane or anything else. You're about to bail off in there and fight with more or less a tiger, but a bull. He had never been ridden. My traveling partner at the time, Brian Richardson, had rode him like 7.8 seconds, and I rode rode him six. And I was like I had my stuff together, and he right. sure enough bucked, but he won. You know, mm-hmm. he bucked me off, but I was like, I can do this. You know, I can compete at this level.
You survived.
Yeah, so, and I survived. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I seen that sucker hit some guys in the face before and just smash their face, jerk them down and hit them so hard in the chest, he like threw them 20 foot up in the air. Like just some unbelievable things that you see the human body go through that you don't really think an animal's that strong until you see them hit somebody with their head and they go 20 feet in the air. You think, oh, well, that's not a big deal or whatever. But when you see it in mm-hmm. person, I know in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, 1 year, this bull hooked my friend Zeb Lanham. He was getting up off the ground and trying to get out of the way, and he wasn't able to get out of the way. And that bull just caught him with his head and chunked him up in the air. And they did a deal where they measured. He was 36 feet in the air. And he come down and hit like right on his hands, like head first. It broke his arm and messed up his shoulder real bad. Think about the strongest man in the world trying to throw somebody 15 feet in the air, right. much less 36 feet.
Yeah, not
so happy. They're an animal that has a strength that's just ungodly how strong they are.
Obviously, some of them are just meaner than others. Mm-hmm. But how many have you seen that they'll just buck them off and then they kind of go their way? They know they're headed back out to the chute or whatever, the pen.
Nowadays, these bulls are trained because they compete with them mm-hmm. when they're 2, 3, and 4 year olds, really before they send them out on okay. the circuit big time. And so you don't want a bull that's completely crazy. You right. want them to be kind of almost tame and docile, like in the back or in mm-hmm. the pasture or whatever, in the back pens. You work with them and you gentle them down. But when they get in that chute, they know it's game time.
Right.
They're just like a person. They'll jump around. And they'll start hooking the side mm-hmm. of the chutes and stuff, and they're getting themselves pumped up whenever 45 minutes ago you're back there petting them, you know.
Right, so you were making friends with who you were about to ride
yeah.
before.
Depending on the bull, some of them I talk trash to and look at them right in the eyeballs and stuff, maybe kick dirt at them, but some of them
spitting
that
on
you,
them, like, you can't do anything to me right yeah, now.
Some of them you don't want to piss off. So that was one bull that was terrifying, that he wound up getting the best of me, but that was one that sticks out. I think another bull, his name was Drifter, and whenever I was talked about earlier going to these amateur rodeos and stuff, I drew him in Claremore, Oklahoma at an amateur bull riding finals, and he threw me off whenever he was like a 3-year-old. He was young, little. And then I had him again about 6 months later at the pro rodeo at Claremore, Oklahoma, and he threw me off there. And then about a month later, I was at a rodeo in Veneta, Oklahoma, and they didn't have enough entries. They didn't have enough bull riders to kind of make a performance for the fans. And the secretary, she's like, Clint, we don't have enough bull riders tonight. We'll pay your fees if you'll get on an extra bull. So which meaning I would get on the bull I had drawn, and then I'd get on an extra bull to put on a show. And she's like, I saved Drifter for you because I know you like that bull and you've been on him twice before. And I was like, yeah, I'll get on him, you know, whatever.
You're like, thanks.
You know, at that time, that was in 2002, so I wasn't winning just a ton of money. I was still going to these smaller pro rodeos and stuff. And so $100 is $100. And plus what I was going to win, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I got on the bull I had drawn, and he threw me off. So then I get on Drifter, and I ride Drifter, and I know when I get off of him, it's one of the best rides I've ever made. I could just tell this sucker was bucking. And the crowd goes wild, whatever. And after the rodeo, I'm in the secretary's office talking, and the judges come in there, and I was like, guys, that sucker was bucking. What do you think you ought to mark me? And they said, you'd have been 95 points. And it made me sick because that very weekend, because I didn't have the qualifications yet at that time, that very weekend was a rodeo at Ellensburg, Washington that was paying like $20,000, and I think it only took like a 90-point ride to win it. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, if I'd have rode that bull in Ellensburg, Washington mm-hmm. this weekend, I'd have won $20,000. I just did it for 100. That's another place. It's when and where you make the good rides at. That was in 2002. In 2004, Sikeston, Missouri, over by Cape Girardeau. It's a small town, but it's a huge rodeo. There's probably 12,000 people in the stands or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a wild place. Absolutely wild place. I have Drifter drawn in the rodeo, and I ride him. I make the qualified ride, the 8-second ride on him, and they mark me 94 points, which told me that in official competition, them saying that they were going to mark me 95 2 years mm-hmm. previous on the same bull, that was legitimate. Right. And then I was 94 on him at Sikeston and won the rodeo there.
So the way you've described these bulls, talking about they're getting pumped up in the chutes and getting prepared, you see the cowboys jump off and then they turn and they look. They're looking at the board. They're waiting to see what those points are. I feel like the bull has almost like turned around and is watching the board. Like, hey, what'd I score?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What'd I buck today?
There's some of those bulls, like they said that the famous bull Little Yellow Jacket, he used to mess with the other younger bulls. And mm-hmm. they said it almost like he was like showing them how to buck. Or whenever the trailer was leaving the ranch without him, mm-hmm. he would run beside the trailer, like mad that he wasn't getting to go. They said you could drive out in the pasture, which he was one of the greatest of all time. He's the 3-time Bucking Bull of the Year. That you could drive out in the pasture and open the trailer gate, and he would just come get right on the trailer.
We're going to shift a little bit. I mean, we've talking about, you know, how you were coming up, what your journey there was. What year during your career do you feel like was the height of, not even necessarily the height of like your best like stats, your ride career, but your popularity? Because you got quite popular. I mean, there's people all around Mena, Arkansas going, oh, Clint Craig from Mena, Arkansas, you know, and I mean, you were a big deal, Clint.
I don't know. I guess I was around for a long time, you know, and was always kind of hanging around the top guys with my competition level. And then I also did something that not a lot of guys did. I went to rodeos, the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. I went to PBRs, the Professional Bull Riders, and I went to CBRs, the Championship Bull Riders. So like in 2005, it was my goal to make all three finals, which was something that very few people have done. I wound up only ever making the national finals and the CBR finals in the same year. I never did make the PBR finals. That was always a side thing to me. My main goal was to make the national finals rodeo because that's what I grew up watching. In 2005, for most of that year, because of the way tape delays and stuff of TV, so the PBRs, they would be live Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The CBRs would be tape delayed and they would show them like on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. And a lot of the rodeos, they would show maybe on a Thursday night, or they would show them on Sunday night after the live performance of the PBR. So there would be times most of the year of 2005 where I would be on TV in one association on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, another association the next hour on Sunday night, and then on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, I'd be on TV three or four times a week. I think that made me pretty popular.
Didn't you have some endorsements?
I was with Justin Boots for probably close to 10 years. I was with Cinch for probably 6 years.
I've seen numerous photos of cowboys with the backs to me lined up in their Cinch jeans, and Mr. Clint Craig's rear end is in there.
Yeah, it's pretty neat to walk into a Western store and see your picture on the wall or whatever, like on Cinch 2010 through 2015. On the Cinch shirts, they have the little tag that has the cowboy and it says lead, don't follow. At that time, I was on some of those pictures. That's kind of nifty to go into some place and see that.
I think nifty's, that's a good word for it, Clint. I think you're very humble, actually, for the success and the notoriety that you have achieved.
Donna Gay used to always say, nobody cares but your mom. Back then, I might have been a little arrogant, but now you realize that goes away. It's on to the next big thing, and you're more or less in the rodeo industry or the football world or whatever, you know. You're meat for the grinder. So you need to get in there, get your job done, make hay while the sun shines, do the best you can, try to carry it on past your riding days and your ability to compete as long as you can, and when it's over, it's over. You're more or less a has been. They say once a Marine, always a Marine. And I don't think that you can be a bull rider if you don't ride bulls. But I also say that if you competed at the level that I was fortunate enough to compete at, I'm okay with people still calling me a bull rider.
You earned that title and I think you get to keep that title. Well, during the height of your popularity with these endorsements going on, you were doing things like what? Guest webcast broadcaster on ProRodeoLive.com. I mean, you were just all over the place. Were you aware of the level of heartthrob that you had achieved? I'm serious, in that rodeo circuit.
Well,
we've done our research and we've got articles. And these women and some men are falling over themselves talking about you.
It's hard to ignore when you go to the beer tent after the rodeo and you're standing there in the middle of a buffet of whatever you want. So it's kind of hard not to ignore.
Because that's kind of the circuit life too, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way. You know, it depends on how much you decide to partake in it. There's an after party at every show. You really want to keep your head in the game. You always say, well, we'll go and have one beer. Well, sometimes that turns into five or six. What we would always try to do is say, we'll go to the beer stand, but we're not going to go to the bar. So you go to the beer stand for a little while after the rodeo. It shuts down about an hour after the rodeo, but you don't ever want to go to the bar. Anything after 12 o'clock's bad decisions, you know.
I'm going to read you a little excerpt of this article that I pulled up, and this was published in Rodeo News, September 1st, 2009, by Miss Megan Elizabeth Miller O'Terry. She looks like she developed quite the crush on you, but I understand that she was writing this article for a Valentine's special, Jerry, that we found. Right. But this is the line that gets me, and I just want to see your reaction. And I'm sure you've read it, but it's probably been a while since you have.
You don't read your own press clippings.
No, so
that's
no,
what
you
gives
really
you the
shouldn't.
Big head.
Now, Clint doesn't consider himself a poet, but when he talks about the most beautiful drives in America, one would think he is a living, breathing cowboy poet observing the world with his Wyoming sky blue eyes.
Somebody had a crush.
Somebody had a crush.
Well.
And Miss Megan wasn't the only one.
No.
Jerry found a good one.
Oh my goodness. So this was posted on Mimo Muse by Jerome Davis. And he says of you, Clint Craig is adorable. He is so cute and so nice. He was very lucky to interview and photograph you. He also goes on to say that he loves taking photos of cowboys and rodeo, and he finds the sport titillating and gets so excited.
It takes all kinds, I guess.
It does take all kinds.
Well, he says that he wrote an article for Cowgirl Magazine in January of 2010 for their Valentine's issue and asked you the questions, what's sexier, cowboy boots or heels?
Heels.
How does a woman get your attention?
I don't even remember what I said then.
What's your phobia? And then he goes on to ask, what is your favorite body part? Not necessarily that we need you to answer those questions, but when you're asked questions like that, what runs through your mind?
That was before the day of clickbait, but it's just clickbait, you know, headline stuff or whatever. It's, I think, more comedy than anything.
If you you're listening to this podcast, obviously you're not seeing what we're seeing. Clint, you're a good-looking man.
Oh, thank you.
Part of that whole persona that cowboys have going on, I mean, I'm sorry, but the better-looking ones get a little bit more screen time, it appears.
Right. You know, you see guys throughout the years that probably ride better than other guys, but because some dudes are pretty, they get a little more. What do they say? Sex sells.
It does. You're absolutely not wrong there.
Questions like word association, you know, is kind of what I attribute that to. And it's kind of funny to see how somebody's mind works. And so I guess that's what Mr. Jerome Davis was doing there. It's funny that that guy's name's Jerome Davis because the 1996 world champion bull rider's name is Jerome Davis. But I know it wasn't that guy. That's not a question that Mr. Jerome Davis from Archdale, North Carolina would ever ask.
No, I don't believe. Well, he even notes here in this that he has interviewed Ben Jones, J.B. Mooney.
J.B. Mooney.
Austin Meyer, Casey Hayes, Jerome Davis, Clint Craig, and goes on. So we're talking about, like I said, the height of your popularity, about the attention you were receiving from the female portion of that. But like we said, that's just kind of part of the circuit. So, you know, when you're traveling as much as you were, female attention is just a part of it, but it's different female attention in every town, every rodeo. Mm-hmm. Were there ever ones that kind of, I don't want to use the word groupies, that's a bad word.
The word's buckle bunnies.
Buckle bunnies. Thank you. Thank you. He gave me the term I needed, folks. So were there ones that maybe followed from rodeo to rodeo?
You find it most prevalent on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. There was always a group of girls out there, and I think there's a ton of money on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered how these young women in their early 20s or whatever, or whatever age they were, afforded to go to all these events and not just be there for one day, be there 3 or 4 or 5 days. And you figure out over the time they're trust fund kids or whatever, mm-hmm. their parents have made hundreds of millions of dollars, and they grew up kind of in a Western type lifestyle. A buckle bunny is the official term or whatever, but I always called them beer standers. They just hang out at the beer stand and loiter around. And here's another thing that's funny about the beer standers girls is some girls, they like, you call them the timed event guys. They like team ropers or calf ropers or whatever. And then some of them like just bronc riders or bareback riders. Mm-hmm. And some of them will crawl over broken glass, walk by 100 good looking team ropers to stand by an ugly bull rider.
Right.
You know, so it depends on what these girls are into. And some girls don't discriminate against any of it. Those are my favorite.
I want to hear more about traveling. Like you said, you're talking about being out on the West Coast, et cetera, et cetera. I want to know more about the travel life of a bull rider.
So the season would run pretty much from the first of the year, January 1, more or less, and go through about almost to the end of October, about October 31st. So I would usually just spend November and December just in the gym, always working out, getting ready. That's kind of off season. 2 months of just nothing but perfect diet, working out, keeping yourself in shape. I've got 25 pounds on me that I've never seen a bull right now, but I wound up kind of quitting riding bulls is the rigors of your diet. You're almost like a boxer or a UFC fighter. You got to exercise every day. Like my perfect performance weight was like 155 to 165. It was exhausting to keep myself at 155, so 160 I could manage. But to stay at 160, 165, I ate every morning 2 eggs and steamed broccoli. Just grilled chicken. Might not even eat dinner. Might eat a little bit. It got exhausting, and that was part of the reason as I got older, when I stopped getting on at 33, and it became harder with injuries and stuff to stay working out all the time and to just make yourself eat that all the time.
Right.
That became exhausting. You know, the guys that are still going into their late 30s, they're willing to put up with it. So they're lasting 38, 42 years old. Good on them. I admire them.
Yeah.
My friend Artie Meyer is 42 and he still competes at a pretty high level. It doesn't bother him none to eat eggs. That's about it.
Yeah.
He'll take an egg and put it in his mouth, the shell and all. Just.
No.
He looks like a UFC fighter at 42 years old, but that's something that he's willing to endure to be able to still compete.
Right.
I just find it exhausting anymore. You know, I didn't back then, but now I do.
Settled in a little bit.
But as far as the travel goes that you were asking about, so you would leave January 1, start going to what they call the winter run. They're called the building rodeos. Most of them are in the big towns in Texas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, San Angelo. And then there's a ton of them in Louisiana and Mississippi, all through big towns in Louisiana, Lake Charles, Lafayette, whatever, Jackson, Mississippi, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And then Denver, Colorado is also during that time, and Rapid City, South Dakota. I don't know why they have the Rapid City, South Dakota rodeo in January. The coldest I've ever been in my life.
I was gonna say, that's freezing.
The wintertime's not terrible because you're there for multiple days at these rodeos. You ride more than once and you're there for multiple days. So it's pretty enjoyable. But after middle of March, you go to the West Coast and you go Laughlin, Nevada, Red Bluff, California, Clovis, California. And there's rodeos out there, but there's also really good rodeos in Texas too. If you're gonna compete and win money, you almost have to go to to them. Mm-hmm. You'll spend, say, Wednesday night going to a rodeo in Texas, Thursday night going to a rodeo in Texas, then drive all night to Austin or Fort Worth or Houston somewhere, sleep for a couple hours in the parking lot, and then get on a flight at 6 o'clock in the morning and fly to California. Mm-hmm. And then ride there. And a lot of the rodeos in California, they're all afternoon performances because it gets cold at night in California. A lot of people don't realize, but a lot of rodeos are in the afternoon. You know, you drove till 2 or 3 in the morning, slept for 2 hours, mm-hmm. got up at 4 o'clock to catch your plane at 6, fly to California and ride at 2 o'clock that afternoon or mm-hmm. whatever. And then maybe jump in the truck and go to another rodeo somewhere in California for the next afternoon. So you put on between 70 and 100,000 miles a year just driving. That doesn't count your flights and everything like that. I know in 2006, I traveled with the 2005 world champion, Matt Austin. And Matt was terrified of flying. He wouldn't get on an airplane to save his life. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful Christian man, but I think he believed that even Jesus couldn't save him from a plane crash. Anyway, he hired a driver, and we drove to every single rodeo that whole year. And we put on over 100,000 miles that year. We didn't fly anywhere.
Right.
Which we had a guy to help us drive.
But rest in a truck is different than
Well, we had the camper that sits in the bed of the truck, uh-huh. and it's pretty comfortable. We had them booted in, so the whole back glass was out, and it was connected to the cab of the truck. And there's usually a bed right up there in the window. Like, if you weren't sitting in the seat in the front, you could just lay in the bed right there and watch going down the road, play video games, whatever. Uh-huh. Matt, he never got out of the camper. He never touched the steering wheel, never got out of the camper.
He hired a driver.
Because he hired
so that's
a driver.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we paid that driver too as well. But another thing with the travel, like say the 4th of July run, that's called the Cowboy Christmas. So you generally, it starts about, depending on how the weekends fall, June 28th. June 25th, something like that. And it'll go almost through July 6th, 7th, depending on how the weekends fall. So about 10 days there. There's a rodeo every day that you can go to, scattered all over the country. Some of them you can go to 2 a day. You can even go to 3 a day if you get your flights right. Everything works out right. So one of the 2 a days that we would go to is you would always enter Red Lodge, Montana and Cody, Wyoming on the same day. The rodeo starts at 6 at Red Lodge and 8 at Cody. They're about an hour and a half apart. Bull riding's the last event. So you would be riding your bull at Red Lodge about the time the rodeo was starting at Cody. So you ride your bull, jump off, run to the truck. You take your chaps off and stuff, but you wouldn't take your riding pants off or your boots and spurs and everything.
You wouldn't even hardly stop to look at your score.
Right. You just get back there and everybody's doing it. And it's really cool. And it's actually kind of a fanfare deal because all the fans there know that you're doing it, which I never flew out of this rodeo, but a lot of guys would charter planes and stuff. And there was a runway, not even an airport, just a strip. And there's a gate that goes out to the runway strip right behind the bleachers. And so like after each event, there'd be a plane out there, you know, twin propellers, and you could hear it running while the rodeo's going. And these guys would just run after they got off their Bronx or their bareback horses. Mm-hmm. And there would be fans out there, almost like a football tunnel, lined up out to that gate. Just, go get them, guys, go get them, you know. Like, and guys would just be running out to jump on that plane. Uh-huh. You had to do it in the horse events to make it. You had to have a plane. But in the bull riding, they stretched the rodeo out towards the end so you could make it driving 100 miles an hour, but you could still make it. So you go to Cody, Wyoming, and you pull in the rodeo while the barrel racing's going on. You jump out and you run up, and your bull's in the chute, and you put your rope on him and get ready to ride. That's one that you can go to 2 a day. Another thing that you can do, like on the day of the 4th of July, they have a short round at Greeley, Colorado. So you ride earlier in the week, and then if you're in the top 12, you get to come back on the afternoon of the 4th. And because of the time zone, the Greeley, Colorado, mountain time zone, and then there's big rodeos in St. Paul, Oregon, and Molalla, Oregon. They're a suburb of Portland. So you can ride at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at Greeley. That's what time the rodeo starts, 1 or 2. So the bull riding's at the end, so you ride at probably 3 o'clock. You can get a flight out of Denver, which is about 100 miles away. So you get off your bull, same thing, run, jump in the truck, haul ass to Denver, and you've got to know all these back roads because you can't make it going on the interstate or the way Google Maps would take you. You learn all this through older guys teaching you the ropes. And so you take all these back roads like 100 miles to the airport and you're pretty much running like home alone. Like you're running through the airport. You get on the plane after everybody's on there. You barely catch it. And you fly into Portland. You either have somebody leave you a vehicle, have to have somebody pick you up, and you need to know right where that vehicle's at. You don't have much time.
No time to spare.
I mean, you might have 30 minutes to spare here and there, but that adds up fast over that many miles.
Right.
So then you fly into Portland and we would always tell the flight attendants and it really becomes really neat because they know at that time of year because there's so many cowboys traveling and you would just tell the flight attendants, you'd be like, hey, would you let us get off the plane first because we have to make this event. And they would come on the loudspeaker, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you noticed or not, but we have a bunch of cowboys on the plane. If y'all don't mind, would y'all let them shuffle out first? They have an event that they have to get to, and they've only got 45 minutes to make it there. They would much appreciate it, and sometimes they would cheer, you know, like whenever you'd get up to haul butt off the plane or whatever. And sometimes you'd run into flight attendants. You'd be like, ma'am, we're going to this rodeo. And they'd be like, we know. Yeah. We've helped y'all out before. The bull riding is the second event at St. Paul, Oregon. You haul butt to St. Paul. It's about 45 minutes south of Portland there. You ride at St. Paul because the bull riding's the second event. Well, about 30 minutes away at Molalla, Oregon, the bull riding's the last event. Greeley, Colorado, catch a flight out of Denver, fly into Portland, drive 45 minutes, ride at St. Paul, then drive 30 minutes over to Molalla and ride there. And these aren't like your little meaner rodeos. Mm-hmm. St. Paul has got 17,000 people in the stands. Molalla has got 12,000 people in the stands. It's amazing. And when you get done that night at Molalla, you want to talk about exhausted. Because you might have flown or drove 8 to 10 hours to get to Greeley that afternoon. There was one year that I was in Tenasket, Washington on the 3rd, went to Portland, flew out of Portland at 6 o'clock that morning into Denver, caught a ride up to Greeley, rode there, caught a ride back down to the Denver airport, flew back into Portland, and then went to St. Paul and Molalla. And now I'm here again tonight. You know, I done been over to travel around in Colorado. And you do a lot of that. The travel is exhausting.
I was going to say, do you miss it?
Oh, yeah. I would love to still be riding. You don't really pick when you stop riding bulls for some whatever reason. It picks when you stop. If you ride it till the end. Some guys pick, you know, but I say that I quit getting on bulls in 2014, but I quit riding them about the end of 2012. So the last year and a half that I rode, I don't know what it was. I still had the mindset or whatever, but my reaction time, or a lot of us contribute it to being like hitting the head or whatever, which I only ever got knocked unconscious twice in my professional career.
Only twice.
But you do take, I mean, a lot of hard hits and where you see stars and stuff like that. At that point is where your workouts have to become so much more fine-tuned and memory muscle reflex and stuff like that. Like, I can walk a tightrope. I can ride a unicycle. Like, you do all this stuff to work on your balance. And it's like goofy stuff that you do, but you have to do it. Like, you stand around on one foot for hours with your eyes closed for your proper posture riding a bull, to train yourself to keep your head down, because your head is the key. Like, if your head's up, you can't see the bull, and that causes all your other posture to go to crap. Mm-hmm. So, like, you stand around forever with a pencil under your chin. But yeah. You know, the focus and concentration.
Did you decide when to stop riding, or did it decide for you?
More or less, I was getting to where I wasn't riding very good. It was on the 4th of July in Sonora, Texas. A bull stepped right between my shoulder blades. So we know now, I didn't know at the time, it broke the ends off a bunch of vertebrae from basically where your skull attaches to your neck or whatever, all the way down between my vertebrae. It broke the ends off of each. Instead of it being flat, they're rounded like this.
Right, yeah.
What that caused is they get all out of whack and stuff. And I would get the worst crick in my neck and shoulders. Mm-hmm. Like, this went on for months. It looked like I had a broken neck. It made me so sore, I was going to take like 6 months off.
Right.
After that 6 months, I got healthy. I was like, man, I'm really not ready to start back yet. I'm going to take a little more time. And I was enjoying just not being on the road and stuff.
Right.
And then that 6 months off led to more or less me having a little girl. Mm-hmm. And at that point, my focus changed.
Right.
So that was not my main goal, is to be the best bull rider I could possibly be. Right. More, it was to be the best dad I could be. And this is another thing that happens to rodeo guys. When you hear about your wounded warriors, when you hear about them having post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, you think, oh, that's a bunch of BS, you know, unless you're in a traumatic experience, you know, if you got your leg blown off or whatever. You think, well, if you saw some action, but if you were just in the service and you didn't see action, why are you having post-traumatic stress disorder? It has nothing to do with the hard things that you saw. It has to do with the camaraderie that you build, the brotherhood that you build with your guys, everybody having the same common goal of wanting to be the best, wanting to basically live to see another day, and missing home and talking about things that went on at home because you're on the road so much, and talking about, this is the best way for me as a high school educated guy to make over $100,000 a year, and what you're going to do with that money when you get back home if you don't wind up spending all of it trying to go to the next rodeo. So when you quit riding, or riding chooses you to quit, you go through a depression. Like, you're just like, what the heck am I going to do? And I've seen guys that were good bull riders completely fall apart, that had a family even when they were riding and rodeoing, completely fall apart and their family life deteriorate after. And then I've seen guys to go on and pick up and be just as good at something else or whatever. Like, I went through probably 2 years of just absolute agony, you know, just what the heck?
You lost your identity.
You realize that just me walking down the street, there's not any fanfare around that like there is at the rodeo, you know?
Right, right.
You find out you don't have as much game as you think you did.
He's still got game, guys.
You have to figure out, like, I got to find a new passion. I got to figure out what I want to do. So I just kind of threw a bunch of stuff up against the wall. And finally, this sounds goofy, but working in the oil field stuck. I love working on a ranch. You have a little mechanical background or whatever. I work on a drilling rig now. That's a way to make a lot of money. The schedule's awesome because you work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Mm-hmm. So you get to do kind of whatever you want to when you're off. The same way as with bull riding. Mm-hmm. When you're there, it's serious. It's dangerous. It's long hours. And there's kind of a brotherhood there because you live with the guys that you work with.
Right.
Not only do you sleep in a room that's this size mm-hmm. with them, you work with them all day. So mm-hmm. for 14 days, yeah. you're with people nonstop. And that's how it was when you're rodeo.
You're with your crew.
And with your crew. I've come to where I really enjoy it. So that's what I do now. I work on a drilling rig and I enjoy it. It's pretty cool. And I see a future in it in a way to retire in mid-50s and be able to come back.
Still got that element of danger. So, mm-hmm. yeah. so you do plan on coming back home at some point.
Oh,
huh?
yeah, absolutely. So I have my little girl, Jolie. Her mom lives in Texas there where we live. And we're there right now. And I love it down there in Texas
right.
too. That's where all my mm-hmm. friends are at that I made over the years. There's two people in particular, Logan Knibbe and Stephanie Wilfonger. They've been together as a couple since mm-hmm. 2002. And I moved to Texas more or less to be close to them. We mm-hmm. travel together and everything. I love my friends down there. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I kind of moved down there and then wound up having a little girl. And that's where I plan to stay until she's out of school or chooses that she wants to live up here. I enjoy the lifestyle down there and stuff. Yeah. It's pretty neat. It's getting way too crowded for me right now. I'm going to have to endure it for a little while. So
right. Well, we're getting to that point in our show where we do what we like to call lightning round. So these are quick questions, and just the first thing that comes to mind. Don't have to really go into it unless you want to, because sometimes they are pretty dang funny. And we have like a standard set of questions that we ask people, but obviously we pick and choose, you know, kind of based on how our interview went or that type of person. But Jerry added one to my notes real quick, just based on something that you had said. Your first lightning round question: if you were going to join the circus, what would your act be?
Tightrope walker, I guess.
Tightrope walker, yep. Favorite color?
Metallic purple.
That's specific. Uh-huh. Very specific. Okay. If you could have a dinner party with three people, dead or alive, who would they be? They don't have to be famous. Three people, living or dead, ultimate dinner party.
I would love to meet the greatest talk show host of all time, Rush Limbaugh, and sit down with him because he's my best friend that I've never met. I listen to him on the radio almost every day,
okay.
and he makes me laugh so hard. I miss my Papa Don. He died 3 years ago. He was an interesting character, rough, mean, just hard talking. I have 1,000 stories about him, mm-hmm. but I realized not long ago, I was like, I have to remember all these stories because I'm not going to get any more. I think that would be cool to listen to him talk, and heck, I love my good friend Wes Silcock from Utah. We traveled together a lot. I love that guy with all my heart. And he was the 2007 world champion bull rider. We traveled together from 2004 till I quit in 2014. And he's an interesting character and a guy that's fun to sit there and just chat like this.
All right. What artist or song do you have on repeat right now?
I mainly listen to talk radio, like mostly in my life. But if I'm listening to something, I still bang the Chronic 2001, the greatest CD that's ever been made in the history of making any album.
Well, and, if we could grab my cell phone right now, it would be downloaded on there because that's the only full album I have.
That thing has got, I don't know, 1 million miles on it.
It does, doesn't it? Uh-huh. With every single one of our friends from high school, mm-hmm. it's got to mean, because that's 2001. That's when we graduated. That
right.
was,
and in
that
fact,
was our anthem.
At that time, I didn't listen to it that much.
Mm-mm.
But now it just grew on me over the years.
Like
and
you
that,
said,
I just still jam mm-hmm. it and can sing every word to every single song.
Okay, last one. I wasn't even going to ask you this because it's so obvious, but I mean, you did it. So what did you want to be when you grew up?
A bull rider.
A bull
you know,
rider.
I just wanted to.
Here he is.
And I never thought about anything else. My plan was to ride till 36, mm-hmm. 37, but it went away at 33. Got close. Heck, there's so many things that we didn't even get to talk about here. Like, one thing I wanted to touch on is that I actually have documented over 1 million miles. That doesn't even count air miles. And have got to go travel all 43 of the states mm-hmm. a gazillion times over. Brazil and Canada. I was very fortunate to get to do it. And it was the funnest thing you could imagine ever doing.
Well, we might have to have you back for a follow-up. As we wrap this up, my last question for you is if you could give some inspirational words to some young cowboys right now who are just getting their start and, you know, looking at that really, really long road ahead of them, what would you say?
Find somebody that knows what they're doing to learn from. There's a lot of armchair quarterback bull riders out there,
mm-hmm.
and I'll tell you right now, they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
So find somebody that knows what they're talking about. I used to put on some schools. It's really hard and really time consuming. It's something that I plan on getting back to as time goes on, but talk to your older guys that have been there and done that
mm-hmm.
and let them teach you how to do it.
Right.
Listen to every tip that you hear and figure out what's real and what's bullshit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I talk very harshly about this because it's so serious.
Right.
Don't read your own press clippings.
Right.
You know, and get too big ahead. And like the Tyler Childers song, keep your nose to the grindstone and out of the pills. You can drink some beer, but don't drink too much. Don't get run off on drugs. Donnie Gay told me, he said, down this road of life, there's the path. And in each ditch, There's a bunch of shit in it. Mm-hmm. It's okay to get a little shit on you every now and then, but don't get off in it. And so just keep your head and surround yourself with people that you think are like-minded and want to be champions. Always surround yourself with people that are better than you.
Clint, it was an absolute pleasure to visit with you. You're one of my favorite people from my childhood and teenage years. Truly, I've always been impressed with where you took your career and, you know, that you had a dream. You got out of here. You followed it and you did it. I love that you have a daughter. And I love that you're planning on coming back here at some point. Mm-hmm. You're talking about bull riding schools, and Craig Ranch seems like a great place to have one of those.
Yes, absolutely. It is. Yeah. One day it's going to happen.
Well, thank you so very much for coming in.
Yes, thank you for having me. I appreciate it a lot.
It's time for that portion of the show that we like to call Fast Facts with producer Trey. So we had some questions came up during our interview with Clint. And I mean, not so much questions because, gosh, Clint is extremely knowledgeable about his field.
He's a storyteller, and boy, does he have some stories to tell. We definitely need to have him back.
Yes, we're planning for sure to have him back. But a few of the things that we wanted to check on, he mentioned a bull called Yellow Jacket. And he talked about how that bull had won, like, Bucking Bull of the Year and was just an extremely hard bull to ride. And so we asked Trey to dig up a little bit more information on Yellow Jacket for us. What do you got, Trey?
So Yellow Jacket was the PRCA's Bull of the Year and Circuit Bull of the Year in 1997 and 1998. He was actually the father of another famous pro bull named Little Yellow Jacket. And Little Yellow Jacket was a three-time world champion PBR bull consecutively from 2002 to 2004. At one point, he was considered unmatched by any bull in the PBR. Another thing that was mentioned was the Cowboy Christmas. The Cowboy Christmas is a gift show of the Wrangler NFR with an attendance of over 250,000 people.
This was the one where he was talking about these cowboys ending their events and literally having planes that they had chartered waiting on this runway strip.
Flew out of Denver into Portland and then drove to another arena in Portland and then from there drove to another one.
Oh my gosh, there is a ton of rodeos that all fall within that. So I don't think it necessarily is in any
one
specific spot, but they just kind of try to plan out how many they can hit depending on the ones that they want to go to and chartering those planes or making sure they've got the flights right. But that was a story that I really liked that he told about those cowboys running out as soon as they jumped off the back of a bronc or finished whatever event they were in and then were just immediately, like, no time for anything, running out there to the tarmac, which wasn't even tarmac. He said it was like
just some field.
It's just a glorified landing strip out behind the rodeo arena and getting on a plane and then making it to the next rodeo after the next rodeo had already started, but their specific event had not. So just having absolutely no time. And that really spoke to the wear and tear that goes on mentally and physically with cowboys, because not only is their body being worn out from the physical exertion of the events that they're constantly participating in, but I mean, they're their own managers.
Right.
You know, he talked about the scheduling, sitting there and plotting out all the places he needed to go to get his qualifications.
I got mentally exhausted just listening to him tell that part of the story. I am not a well-traveled person, and the idea of coming up with that type of itinerary is too much, too much.
Especially at such a young age. Clint, I mean, he started riding in high school, and he said that basically from the moment he walked out those double doors, he went on the road. And so there he is, 18 years old, just graduated from high school. He's out there on the road alone, but he's having to plot his itinerary and pick his events. That's a lot for someone that age, and they've got to start so young because of that wear and tear on their body. I mean, he decided he was going to try to stop riding by, what, 36, 37. Mm-hmm. He ended up riding his last bull at 33, and I can't help but think that probably had something to do with him starting to ride at such a young age. Mm-hmm. I feel like some of them maybe don't get into it a little bit later, so they've got a little bit of extra time on their body, but it got to him a little quicker than he thought. You can tell he misses it.
Absolutely.
He seems very happy in what he's doing right now, but you can tell that you've not taken the rodeo out of the cowboy at all.
Oh, no way. No way.
No, he loves it. Well, we had a great time visiting with him. And as always, we want to thank you for listening to the Washita Chronicles. You can find us along with other great shows at thewashitapodcast.com. You can contact us by email at thewashitapodcast@gmail.com. And make sure that you find us on Facebook and give us a like.